Rob invited me to, so I'd like to thank Rob for inviting me to come and give a Quantum Foundations seminar. So Rob asked me to give a seminar on this topic of weak values. What I actually offered to give a seminar on was this work on quantum discord is Bohr's notion of non-mechanical disturbance introduced to answer EPR. And it's too late, Rob, now. You can't stop me. No, that's just a joke. I actually will be talking about weak values. But I did want to throw up this slide just to advertise this talk, this work, because I don't think that it seems like I'll probably never get a chance to actually talk about it anywhere because it's too abstruse. But I liked it, and it's just about to be published in Annals of Physics. Okay, but what I'm actually going to talk about, as I said, is weak values. And so I'm going to begin by defining what weak values are, then talking about their properties, before getting on to then how they're actually useful in foundations of quantum mechanics, or the phrase which I'm using here, fundamental questions in quantum mechanics, which I guess I think of as being slightly broader and not necessarily as philosophical, if you like, as the real foundations of quantum mechanics, but nevertheless interesting to a sort of common community of people. So I'll be talking about a number of those applications, some in more detail than others, and then I'll get on to conclusions. Okay, so to begin with, I'm going to explain all about weak values, essentially. So this is an idea which goes back, for those who don't know, to a PRL in 1988 by Aharonov, Albert, and Weidman, which had the intriguing title of How the Result of a Measurement of a Component of the Spin of a Spin Half Particle Can Turn Out to Be 100. Okay, and so obviously we'll explain how that is. So what they did was consider what they actually considered was a spin half particle, of course, but I'm going to consider an arbitrary system observable A. Okay, so here I have a system. There's some observable A we're interested in, and we're going to get information about that observable by coupling the system to a probe. Okay, and the probe is going to be, in their paper, was described by position and momentum variables, and it was initially prepared in a minimum uncertainty state. Okay, so the probe state is defined by, therefore, just three variables, the initial uncertainty in the probe momentum, the initial mean probe momentum, and the initial probe position, which for simplicity I'll just take to be zero. Okay, so we have some sort of coupling here, and then if in particular what they assumed, you won't see exactly this equation in their paper, but essentially what they assumed was a von Neumann type coupling between the system and the probe. Here's my system operator, here's my probe position, okay? So you can think of this as being a force on the probe which is proportional to the system operator A, okay? And then it acts for some time, so we integrate it up. It results in an impulse to the probe. An impulse to the probe precisely equal to the system observable A. Okay, so this is a Heisenberg picture equation relating the final probe momentum to the initial probe momentum and the system observable A. Okay, so clearly then there's information in the final probe momentum about A, and indeed we can make an estimate of A simply by measuring this PF. Okay. And subtracting, obviously we can't subtract the initial probe momentum because that's not a number, right? It's a quantum observable. But what I can do is subtract the mean initial probe momentum, right? Okay, and that then is what I've defined my estimate of the system observable A based on measuring this probe. Okay, so far nothing actually about weak measurements or anything, and even before I get to weak measurements, I want to talk about initial and final state. So everything I've said so far is just talking has been that we had the system in some initial state, which I might as well take to be pure in this case, and so it won't be difficult for you to believe this equation here that that if the mean value of the estimate of the system observable A based on measuring the probe for a system prepared in this state, psi is just the usual quantum expectation value. Okay, hopefully that doesn't stretch anybody's mind. Okay, now what the interesting thing that Aharonov, Albert, and Weidman did in this paper was also consider doing what's called post-selection. Okay, and what that means is that as well as this measurement on the probe, they also consider a measurement on the system following an interaction. Okay, and they post-select the values on getting a particular answer from this this measurement here. So they assumed it was a projective measurement, okay, so that the system is projected into state phi f. And post-selecting simply means that you calculate the expectation values of you know of this estimate as a function of pf only for the sub-ensemble where this measurement gave you the result you want, where you got phi f coming out here. And so, yeah, so this is how I'm going to notate then this post-selected average value as involving both the initial system state and the final system state phi f. Right, so where weak measurements come in is in this limit. Okay, so remember that there was, that we had three observables of which really two of them were pretty irrelevant. The means, the only relevant aspect of the probe which remains was the uncertainty of its momentum. And the weak measurement limit is the case where that uncertainty goes to infinity. And what you get in that case is that what they showed was that this expectation value of this estimate is given by this formula here. Okay, and I'll come back and talk about this formula in a minute. So this is not probably to many of you a familiar looking formula, and I'll talk more about it. But before doing that, I want to say why is this in fact the weak measurement limit? So there are two answers to that. So it's a weak measurement in the sense that there is very little information in any individual result. Okay, you're only getting, you're weakly interacting with the system because you can see here is this is the operator for the estimate of the system. Okay, so this is now completely in the Heisenberg picture, right? So A of PF was the functional form of the estimate. I now put in that operator and write it out, and you see that it's equal to the thing that I'm trying to estimate, A, plus this correction term, right, which is the operator for the initial probe momentum minus the mean of it. Okay, but that's precisely this thing which has an infinite variance. Okay, so in this weak measurement limit, any individual estimate is what you want plus a term which is a noise term, if you like, which is infinitely large. Okay, so that's the sense you're only getting an infinitesimal amount of information from each measurement. And we can also see the weakness of that measurement in its back action on the system, because if you're only getting an infinitesimal amount of information, then it should be the case that you can do that with only an infinitesimal amount of disturbance to the system. And again, we can see that most clearly in the Heisenberg picture. If I calculate for an arbitrary system operator S, what is that final operator? So with the binomial interaction, that's very easy to do. It's simply this expression here. It's the initial one plus this term here. Okay. And what you see is that the size of this term is determined by the size of Q in, right? And with the way I defined it, with the mean of Q in being zero, this is also just a noise term, but the size of that term goes to zero in this weak measurement limit because of the position momentum uncertainty relation. Okay, so as the momentum uncertainty goes to infinity, the position one goes to zero. Okay. So that's the both senses in which they are. Now, of course, to calculate an average like this, I mean, to calculate any expectation value in quantum mechanics, you have to repeat measurements many times, okay? Because every measurement is going to have statistical noise in it. When you have a weak measurement, that's still the case. But in fact, the number of times you have to repeat the measurement is going to go up more, okay? And in fact, it's going to be infinitely many in this actual limit where this goes to infinity, okay? Because each individual result has so much noise in it. But in principle, of course, people can actually do experiments, and I'll be talking about and showing experimental results later. So it's not as if this is a killer for the whole idea. Okay, and I should say, please interrupt me at any point if you'd like clarification. No. Okay, all right. Okay, so as I said, this was the what they showed that pre and post selected weak value would come out to be equal to. Well, what they called it the weak value. But actually, what they called the weak value was this fraction without the real part. Okay, so to go back to the previous slide, what they actually showed was that this it came out to be the real value of that, but they defined the weak value to be this complex fraction here. Okay, yes?
I have a question about the bottom of the previous slide.
Yeah.
Says required to obtain a reliable average.
Mm-hmm.
Do you usually consider reliable?
Well, I guess one could say that if one repeated the entire set of experiments again, one would expect to get something very close to it.
But in general, say, I'm thinking of some maybe parameter epsilon, and you're thinking about for every epsilon sufficiently.
So, sorry, what's your epsilon? What's
parameterizes reliability, and if you pick an epsilon, then you need to perform a certain number of measurements in order to get such a reliable average.
Sure.
So what form does the reliability take? How do you express it mathematically?
So I hadn't thought to express it mathematically, but I think it could be something like, yeah, if you want an estimate that has, for which I have a, for which I can say that the mean square error is less than some value, then I can tell you how many times you need to repeat the experiment to do that. Does that sound reasonable?
Okay, so you calculate the reliability in general in terms of standard deviation, something like that?
Well, I'm just saying that would be the easiest way to do it. I mean, I'm sure, I'm sure one could also do calculations with confidence intervals or any way you want to do it. But, yeah, but I have not gone into those details. And it's a good question as whether, I mean, has anybody in this field, you know, set out to answer that question? I'm not sure. But I don't think there's anything really in principle different from this from any other sort of ensemble average in quantum mechanics. So I don't think it would be a hard question to answer if one really wanted to. Yes?
I vaguely remember, I think it was by Whiteman, an article which says that you could do it with a single measurement. I was surprised because this is supposed to be a statistical thing. So does a single measurement ever lead to a weak measurement?
Does a single measurement ever give you a weak value?
Yeah.
The short answer, I think, is no. I mean, I think this is the right way to think about weak values. Is that like any other value in quantum mechanics, the only way to obtain them is by repeating an experiment multiple times. But in this case, you have the number of repetitions has to be even larger because of the weakness of the measurement. So there's nothing magical about weak values in that sense. I'm not sure exactly what the statement that Weidman made, but I'm sure he would recognize this fact, but on the other hand, that school of researchers has a particular way that they like to make provocative statements, let's put it that way, which if you dig deeply enough, you know, you can agree with, but on face value, they seem, seem crazy. Any other questions? Okay, so as I said, so they actually define the weak value to be this complex number, but I am going to restrict it to being the real part, I think probably in this field these days most people do this, although I wouldn't necessarily hold to that statement. So here's a picture from their original paper. I'm not actually going to go into the details, but they had a very physical model for their their system observable A would spin in some direction, and their probe was simply the position degree of freedom of the particle to which that spin was attached, so to speak. And they had this real apparatus of how you could actually go and do the experiment. I'm not going to go into any of those details. What I am going to point out is that the most interesting thing, and obviously this is related to the title of their paper, is that this weak value, as just defined here, is not restricted to lie within the eigenvalue range of the observable A. Okay, so in particular, in their case, it can be, essentially it can be arbitrarily large. And the way it can be arbitrarily large, just from a mathematical point of view, as you see, an expression like this can be very large if the denominator is very small. So if your post-selected state is very different from your initial state, and remembering that there's essentially nothing happening in between initial and final except for this weak measurement, so post-selecting on something very different, almost orthogonal, is going to happen very rarely. So there's an extra amount of rare, problem in doing the experiment. But nevertheless, if you do that post-selection, then this comes out to be can come out to be a very large number. Okay. So that was the original Aharonov, Albert, and Weidman approach. And what you might say is, well, this is all seems very particular. You have to have this Gaussian minimum uncertainty state and this particular sort of coupling. And all right, so yes, you get this, but what's the significance of it? What does it mean anything beyond this particular setup, which Aharonov, Albert, and Weidman came up with? So it turns out that actually it's a surprisingly robust quantity, and that one can obtain it with much weaker sort of assumptions, which I'm going to set out here. So they look actually like a lot more assumptions, but that's just because we're allowing ourselves to be much more general. So to begin, I'm going to introduce the language of generalized measurements, because this is the way I want to state it. Probably this is familiar to everyone, but we'll very briefly go through it. So I'm going to restrict, because that's what I need to do to get the result I want, to purity-preserving measurements. And those are measurements which can be described by measurement operators, so a set of measurement operators. K labels a result. They're complete in the sense that the sum over these positive operators is equal to the identity, and they're related to the measurement operators by this E equals M dagger M. Okay? And so these measurement operators, as well as specifying these E's, they specify the update rule for the state under a result K, which is that rho goes to this unnormalized state, rho tilde sub K, which is MK rho MK dagger. And so, of course, these being probability operators, the trace of these unnormalized states is simply the probability of that outcome K occurring. Okay, so that's the most general way we can describe purity-preserving measurements. So for weak measurements, the way I'm going to define it is, so actually there is, in a strict sense, no such thing as a weak measurement. What we actually need to do is consider a weak family. So that is a family of purity-preserving measurements with some parameter epsilon, such that that parameter is analytic in that epsilon, and that in the limit that epsilon goes to zero, each one of these measurement operators goes to a constant, okay, and that the leading order term is of order epsilon. Okay, so that's what I mean by weak measurements. I'm going to also require these measurements to be minimally disturbing, okay, which corresponds to saying that these measurement operators are going to be Hermitian, okay, so there's no extra unitary happening on top of that. We want to consider this to be a measurement of the observable A, which is to say that these probability operators should simply be functions of that observable A that we're interested in. And then I'm going to steal some ideas from some recent work by Dressel and Jordan and some of their co-workers, where they introduce a notion of generalized eigenvalues so that one can talk about an A estimating measurement. That's one where there exists these generalized, what they call generalized eigenvalues, such that the sum over these probability operators or positive operators, E times these alphas, is equal to the A that you want. Okay, so note these E's are not projectors; they're not necessarily the projectors onto. Well, no, they definitely can't be projectors because of the structure they have to have. But nevertheless, by adding them up with suitable numbers here, real numbers, I can get the observable A. So this is like a generalized spectral decomposition of an observable A. And that's why they call them generalized eigenvalues. They also call them contextual values, but that's perhaps a little confusing. So if one has that, then if one does the measurement just described and get result an average over the all possible results with and assigning the number alpha k to a particular result k, then I simply get the expected value of the observable A. Okay. So then if one has post-selection, which we want to introduce, of course, with, in general, to not to restrict to post-selecting on a projector or a particular rank one projector, but rather just an arbitrary effect, okay, so this is different from the other measurement. This is the later measurement, the post-selecting measurement. Then the mean of these generalized eigenvalues is going to look like this. So I'm now have to talk about the probability of getting result k given this preparation and given this final result, right? Given the final result corresponding to this effect here. Is this complicated expression here, okay? And it's not only a complicated expression, it's even very difficult to work out in general. But what they showed, so this is, there are some subtleties in this theorem, and I'm not talking about them all, and so that's particularly why there's this big bold typically here, because actually there are instances where all of this doesn't work, but nevertheless, typically one can say that if one has a weak family of A estimating purity preserving, meaningfully disturbing measurements of A, typically it is the case that post-selecting on the result with this effect will yield a mean value, which I've just been talking about, which is given by this expression here. Okay, and so this is, if you now then put in the special case where the initial state is a pure state and the final POVM is a projector onto another pure state, this reduces back to the weak value, or the real part of the weak value defined by Aharonov, Alvin, and Biden. Okay? So this I am going to call a weak value. Okay. In the general sense, so there's nothing special about wave functions. Again, some Weidman, for example, I think would not like that. But I think that operationally, this is the general expression which it makes a lot more sense to think about. Yes, Rob.
In one of your assumptions about the measurement operators, the POVM EK.
On this slide or the previous slide?
Yeah, on the previous slide. Was there anything that prohibited them from being an overcomplete basis for the operator space? Because if they are not necessarily linearly independent, there could be many decompositions of A into the EKs.
Oh, absolutely. That's part of the, yeah. So there's absolutely no, there are infinitely many families which satisfy all of these conditions.
I was talking about the uniqueness of this set of generalized eigenvalues.
That's right. So in general, there is no given these EKs, the set of generalized eigenvalues is not unique. That's absolutely right.
And then this theorem is true for every set of eigenvalues?
No, and that's part of the reason why this typically is here.
So there's some sort of measure over the space of sets of eigenvalues?
Well, I don't. I don't think anybody has been that precise. No, one can set out more conditions to avoid this problem. But I thought that it's actually more illuminating rather than going through all of those conditions just to say that. And I think that this is morally true to say that this is typically the case. But I can't give you a technical definition. What I can say is what they actually propose is that if one is in this situation where this is an overcomplete set, then one can use the more Penrose pseudo-inverse to get a unique answer, a unique set of alpha k's. But that's not to say that you're restricted to those. But if you do use those, then that's a very robust set, and then this typically has a weaker meaning if one also puts those constraints on.
So if it isn't an overcomplete basis, it's just that the EKs are no more than d squared in number, then this result always holds? Then the alpha k's would be unique.
I think, then the alpha k's would be unique, but I think there are still, there still may be some very peculiar choices of how, of the scaling of this with this weak parameter, and I wouldn't guarantee that to be the case. But I think, let me put it this way, that none of these problems have turned up in any of the experiments that people have done, for example. So, I mean, I really think one can mathematically construct cases where these things diverge or converge to any value that you want them to have. But I think that those are really fine-tuning arguments that you have to make for that to happen. So I think that although I can't give you a an exact definition, I think that it's that it's pretty reasonable to say that typically you get out this unique answer, which I define here. Okay. Yeah. So this has been a discussion in the literature in the last couple of years about precisely what you need to get this result. And I didn't want to go through all that, which is why I was sweeping a lot under the rug with this. Okay. But yes, but just look up Dressel and Jordan, and I can't remember the name of the guy that they were arguing with. But yeah, if anyone's interested, I'm sure you'll be able to find it. Okay. Any other questions? Yep.
Is there a simple way of estimating the deviation from the weak value for a finite epsilon?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't written down the formula. I'm pretty sure it would be easy to work out. And what you would find if you did that would be that for any finite value of epsilon, it would be relatively easy to choose or to go back to the initial pure state one, maybe to just make it easier. For any finite value of epsilon, if you make this this post-selected state sufficiently orthogonal from your input state, then you will not get experimentally this result here. So that was the sense in which I said that there is no such thing as a weak measurement, which will work for any pre and post selection. You have to have a weak family, and you know, given, so if you tell me what your pre and post selection is going to be, I can tell you how weak it has to be in an experiment. Yeah, but I haven't said how you would work that out. But I mean, I don't even know if there probably is a simple formula, but the easiest thing is you just calculate it out and see what it has to be, because certainly numerically this is not a difficult thing to work out. It's just analytically it's terribly messy. Okay, so that was defining what weak values are. Now I want to talk about their properties. And so I'm going to talk about, so to begin with, expected and perhaps unexpected properties. So there are some expected properties. From the way they're constructed, they obey linearity. Okay, so the weak value, if the observable C is equal to the sum of observable A plus B, then the weak value for C is going to be the sum of the weak values for A and B. Okay, that's pretty obvious. A less trivial property is one called consistency with strong measurements. And what that means is that if one is in the situation of having pre and post selection, and if between that pre and post selection one did a strong measurement of A, and that strong measurement, in other words, projective measurement, always yielded the answer, which will be an eigenvalue of A, little a, right? Then the weak value is also going to have that same value. It's going to equal that eigenvalue. Okay? So that's saying if you have pre-selection, strong measurement, and post-selection, and that experimental setup would always give you the same answer for the measurement in the middle, then the weak value is going to do the same thing.
Howard, when you say would yield, you mean would be predicted to be based on both the pre and the post-selection?
That's right, yes. So in that situation where you have pre and post selection with those results, the measurement in the middle would always have given you that answer. Okay, so an unexpected, although perhaps not if you've been paying attention in the early part of my talk, is that you have these anomalous weak values. In other words, the fact that it's not a theorem that the weak values lie in the eigenvalue spectrum of the observable A. So you might be still wondering, like, how is this possible? How can you get a value from observable which doesn't lie in the eigenvalue spectrum? And in terms of the general theory I gave, it's because these generalized eigenvalues themselves are not constrained to be in the eigenvalue spectrum. And in fact, they have to, for sufficiently small epsilon, they have to lie outside the eigenvalue range. So some of the values which you're assigning to your estimate of A have to be, to get your estimate of A, have to be in the limit epsilon goes to zero, well outside the eigenvalue range for A. And so it's not surprising that it's possible then that when you post-select on a particular ensemble of those, that you can pick out those that happen to be much larger or much smaller or whatever. Okay, so I tried to explain this in prosaic terms, and maybe I've done too good a job. And so you might be asking at this point, well, how interesting is this really? Isn't this just sort of, for example, isn't this just the sort of crazy weirdness which you expect from quantum mechanics when you have post-selection, and does it really have anything to do with weak measurements? And so the answer to that is no. So it does have something to do with weak measurements in the sense that if I do projective measurements as my intermediate measurements, so instead of the MKs being weak, they're actually projectors, and so then the generalized eigenvalues really just are the eigenvalues of A. So in that case, you can show that the average, the weak pre and post-selected average for this projective measurement or strong measurement does lie in the eigenvalue spectrum of A. Okay? So it's not just to do with the post-selection, it has to do with the weakness. But then you might be thinking now, well, okay, so it has something to do with weak measurements, but does it really have anything to do with quantum mechanics? Isn't just the crazy sort of thing which you'll get with when you have post-selection and weak measurements, it's not really anything to do with quantum mechanics. So again, the answer is no, because if either the final POVM commutes with the observable A, or the initial state commutes with A, then again, the weak value is going to lie in this eigenvalue spectrum. So you only get anomalous weak values like this when there is some essential non-commutivity happening, and when the measurement is not strong. It has to be sufficiently weak. Okay, so I hope that's convinced you that there is, that there's something interesting about the fact that you get these. It's inherently to do with weak measurements and quantum mechanics. So what I want to do with these properties now is introduce the idea of weak probabilities, because this is going to be important later. So again, I'm going to actually specialize to the case where the observable I'm interested in is a projector. Okay. So in fact, an eigenprojector for this observable B. So if I do a weak or strong measurement or estimate of a projector, of course, that's just going to be a probability. In standard quantum mechanics, the expectation value of a projector is a probability. It's the probability for this eigenvalue, for the system to be in the eigenstate corresponding to this eigenvalue. So that's without post-selection. When we have post-selection and a weak measurement of this projector, I'm going to call this a weak probability. Okay, simply because it is something that we would expect if I was in this classical case where things commuting, this would be a number between 0 and 1. But I'm going to call it, as I said, a weak probability, because with this weak, they just remind you that because it's quantum mechanics, it's not necessarily going to be between 0 and 1. So this is not a probability, it's a weak probability. Something that corresponds to a probability in the classical setting. Okay, so now it's further specialized for this final estimate to be, final POVM to also be a projector, okay? And then I'm also going to then call this thing a weak probability. So by this I mean the weak value for the weak value for the intermediate projector multiplied by the probability of the final projector, okay? So this is like a joint probability distribution for the observed, for getting the intermediate result B and the final result F, given the system is prepared in the initial state. So that I'm going to call also called the weak probability. So you could, just to remind you, so the time ordering here is this the initial, this is the intermediate, and this is the final measurement. Okay, so the interesting thing is that you have a nice simple formula for this weak value probability. It's simply linear in the state, and it's simply the real part of the trace of this projector times that projector times the state. Yes?
I'm just wondering whether one can say something general about the sum of the weak probabilities.
Well, yeah, I'm just about to talk about their properties here. Yeah. Okay, so this distribution is actually well known. It was introduced in 1961 by Marganow and Hill as a joint distribution for two observables, F and B. Okay? And it has the properties indeed that, so certainly if I sum over F and B, I just get unity. okay, as you'd expect from a probability, and this follows from the linearity conditions for weak values. But moreover, if I sum over one of these, I get the true quantum mechanical marginal distribution for the observable F. And if I sum over the F, obviously from the way they're constructed, doesn't matter. If I sum over the F, I get the true quantum mechanical distribution for the observable B. And further on, it's also the case that if I consider any quadratic function of these eigenvalues B and F, that the expectation value for that quadratic function is the true quantum mechanical expectation value for the quadratic function of those operators B and F. Okay, so these are rather nice properties of this, what I'm calling this weak joint probability distribution. So for example, and so this is going to become important later, which is why I'm introducing it, if I look at the difference between B and F raised to the power n, where n is either 0, 1, or 2, then that's going to equal the quantum mechanical expression for that power of the difference between the operators B and F. Okay? All right, and so then this is the last slide on this, properties of weak values. I want to talk about the fact that we can use the weak measurements like this to really probe the unknown, okay? In the sense that, okay, obviously to measure A, if you're going to make a weak measurement of A, you sort of have to know what it is that you're measuring, right? But there are other things in your experiment which don't have to be known. Okay, so for example, the initial state may be unknown, and you could have some unknown evolution between the time when you prepared the initial state and the time at which you do the weak measurement, which I'll call TW. Okay, then we have to know what weak measurement we're doing, and then when we do the final projection, if we think of the one experiment who's doing both of those measurements, well, you sort of have to know what is the effect that you're finally measuring to do the post-selection. But again, it could be unknown in the sense that there's evolution between the weak measurement and that final post-selection. So really, you know, relative to the time at which the weak measurement was done, this is like Heisenberg picture evolution, that the final projection, final measurement, final post-selecting measurement, is also an unknown in that sense. So when we work out a weak value like this, okay, all of these things in red here could be unknowns in the system. If I'm just the experimenter doing the measurements, I don't need to know how the system is prepared, how it evolved prior to the weak measurement, or how it evolved after the weak measurement. Okay? So the only things I need to know is the post-selecting measurement I'm doing and the observable that I'm actually measuring as the weak value. And again, this is something which is going to be important, which I'll come back to later. Okay. All right, so now I'm going to talk about how we can apply this theory, or how this theory has been applied in various theory and experiments relating to fundamental questions in quantum mechanics. But before going through each one of these individually, I just wanted to make some general remarks about what weak values are offering for fundamental questions in quantum mechanics. Okay, so there are many fundamental questions in quantum mechanics which have ambiguous answers. Okay, that's perhaps one of the hallmarks of these sorts of questions. They're questions where we would like quantum mechanics to give an answer, but it just doesn't give a clear answer. So often it's the case that then weak values do offer answers to the questions. Okay. In some cases they may be a completely new answer to the question. In some cases, there have been a number of already answers given already, but the weak valued one will single out one of those from which have been previously proposed. And in either of these cases, knowing what the answer the weak values gives can give new insights into the problem and prompt new research about the problem. And even if they don't give any new insights or prompt any new research, at least what they can do is prompt experimentalists to go out and do experiments, and I think that's a good thing because it brings these sorts of issues to the attention of a wider audience than you typically get from purely theoretical papers. So I think that's a good thing. And then another way, a sort of different way in which I see weak values offering something to these fundamental questions is that even when there are situations where there is an answer that people more or less agree upon, That answer might be seem to be, you know, very theoretical, very contrived, very far from anything you could do in an experiment. But what you often find is that weak values actually give a natural operational meaning to some of these answers. And so, again, what that does is allow an experiment to be done, which, as I said, I think is a good thing. Okay, so with that motivation, then I'll talk about some of the applications which have been done. So the first one, and I think this was, some of the work which sort of revitalized interest in weak values, was to do with this question of tunneling, quantum tunneling, and how much time does a particle spend under the barrier. Okay. So again, so this is a typical sort of nonsensical question in quantum mechanics. We're told we're not allowed to ask that question. We can just observe the particle after it's tunneled, but we can't observe the particle while it's in there because that would upset the whole tunneling process. Okay. Nevertheless, they didn't stop theoreticians from giving answers to these questions. And so, for example, there was the dwell time was proposed by various people. I can't tell you who exactly. Where here this pi b is the projector onto the barrier region where the particle is supposed to be. Another answer was given by Boudicca, obviously, called the Boudicca time, which was related to a physical model with a particle carrying a spin, and it was how much rotation that spin suffered as the particle was tunneling if it had a Hamiltonian like this. So what Ephraim Steinberg did in 1995 was suggest applying weak values to this problem. Okay. So he suggested considering a weak measurement of whether the particle is in that barrier region, integrated over the whole time of the experiment, and looking at the weak value of this of a measurement of this observable. And so what he showed was that the what I'm calling the weak value, the real part of this this expression, post-selected on the particle actually tunneling, the particle making it through the barrier, was in fact equal to the dwell time, as had been originally proposed. Interestingly, in this case, it turns out that the imaginary part of the weak value is also relevant because the absolute value of the weak value, as originally defined by Aharonov, Alban, and Weidman, is actually equal to the Boudicca time. So this was an example where weak values, if you allow for the imaginary part at least, gives you both of these answers which had previously been proposed. But I mean, in my thinking, this is sort of the right answer in the sense that, I think the real value is the significant part of the weak value. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about tunneling, because that was, as I said, quite old work, but it prompted, I think it was the first work which actually was an application of weak values rather than just looking at them as this weird thing that isn't this curious. It was actually trying to use them for something. Okay, so now I'm going to skip to something very recent, actually unpublished, and this is some work with my colleagues at Griffith University. So before saying anything about weak values, the way I think of this work fitting in is with Feynman's explanation of Bell non-local correlation. So many of you probably know, well, okay, let's start. Okay, so consider the CHSH test of Bell non-locality. I can think of this as being measuring the expectation value of this observable here. So x and z are qubit operators, p and q are also just qubit operators here. So in a local hidden variable theory, I can think of each of the outcomes of these measurements as being predetermined. Okay, so these are just functions of some hidden variable. And so the expectation value of an operator like this is going to be, I can just replace these operators by variables that have certain values. Okay, so I have some sort of probability distribution over x, z, p, and q, right? Even though quantum mechanics says I can only measure x or z and I can only measure p or q, and nevertheless, in a hidden variable theory, all of those things are predefined, or I can think of them that way. And under that assumption, you can derive the Bell inequality where this CHSH parameter has to be less than or equal to 2. Okay, so Feynman, in a paper in 1991, I pointed out that, of course, there is a way that you can get the quantum mechanical expression of 2 root 2 from this expression here, simply if you allow these probabilities not to lie between 0 and 1. Okay, and so he called his paper negative probabilities, and that was exactly what he was proposing. Okay? That was his explanation of Bell's theorem. Now, of course, there are infinitely many possibilities, or infinitely many possibilities for these negative probabilities, even with the constraints that all the marginals which you can actually observe, where you measure one observable on each side, have to be reproduced from your probability distribution here, which is not constrained to be positive. Okay, there are infinitely many possibilities. It's just the way the equations work out. You have many degrees of freedom. So what we thought was, well, what answer do you get from weak values? Okay, this is one way which we can actually get a unique answer for these probability distributions, because this is precisely the sort of the weak probabilities that I defined before. So the idea is that one can make a weak measurement, although one can, you know, can't make a strong measurement of an X and Z, one can certainly make a weak measurement of Z prior to making a measurement of X, and make a weak measurement of Q prior to making a measurement of P. And what this should do is give you probabilities here which actually correspond to the CHSH value which you get. And so you can see that there are some experimental data hiding here, and so that's what we did. So this green here is the CHSH parameter, and there's the classical value or hidden variable value, level hidden variable value 2, and so you can see it crosses that at this point here as a function of how entangled the state is. And what you see is that at exactly that same point, the theoretical curves, which fit very well with the data, for these measured weak value joint probabilities, cross out of the eigenvalue spectrum of between 0 and 1 at that same point. Okay, so these are, here we're measuring weak value probabilities bigger than 1, and here we're measuring them less than 0. Okay, and so, I mean, I think that's just a nice demonstration of how you can make Feynman's idea uniquely defined and actually measure them experimentally. But as I said, that's actually unpublished. Okay, the next one I'm going to talk about is one that I've actually talked about at Perimeter before, but I'll talk about it again briefly now. So this was an idea of mine to do with Bohmian mechanics. So I'm hoping everybody here knows something about Bohmian mechanics, because I'll be going through it very quickly. So this is a non-local hidden variable theory in which one has an ontology of a world point in configuration space, okay, and that is describing my reality. So it evolves according to some deterministic equation with a velocity determined by where that particle is in configuration space and by the wave function of the universe in general psi. Okay, now there are infinitely many functional expressions for the velocity field as a function of the state and of the, you know, of the real wave function and of the configuration of the universe, which are consistent with the quantum mechanical prediction. So in other words, which have the property that if I take my initial probability distribution as being the standard one that quantum mechanics gives, and I evolve it according to this velocity distribution by this flow equation, that this solution remains the solution. So in other words, the quantum mechanical distribution remains the actual solution. Okay, so this is sort of a problem for Bohmian type theories, that there are infinitely many theories, in fact, because there are infinitely many velocity fields I could write down. But what it turns out is that, again, with weak values, I can actually define a unique answer. And to me, it's a very natural answer, and that's simply to make a weak measurement of the position of the particle, immediately followed by a strong measurement, okay? Look at the difference between those two values, okay? So that's just the distance that, you know, classically you'd think that's just the distance the particle traveled in time t, and then simply divide by time t, and of course you're post-selecting on getting the strong measurement at the point that you're interested in here. And, well, again, that actually is a weak value. If you work that through, that's exactly what it means. And if one does that, this turns into exactly the standard Bohmian expression for the velocity field. So I thought that was very nice that it actually it reproduces the standard bone mechanics in that sense. But more interestingly, what it also does is allow one to measure these things experimentally, okay, to measure these velocity fields. And as I said in the other paper, even for a naive experimentalist to make this measurement. So the idea being is that all you have to do is be able to make weak measurements of position. This is not exactly the way it was done, but it was pretty similar in this paper by Kosis and co-workers, and Ephraim Steinberg, published in Science in 2011. And so what they did it with photons, and these are reconstructed flow lines with that Bohmian velocity field, which they inferred without any knowledge of Bohmian mechanics, simply by doing weak measurements and post-selection. Okay? So I want to stress that these lines that you're doing here is not following an individual particle. Of course, we know that you can't do an experiment and follow an individual quantum particle any more accurately than the uncertainty relation relies. What this is doing is making a local point, making a measurement of the velocity field, which in this case is just a one-dimensional number because this is just in one dimension, right? Getting a particular value and then saying, well, I know that this particle here is going to have traveled in this direction a certain amount, so then the next time that I want to measure the velocity field, I'll do it at that point to which that particle has traveled, and then I can just continue that process, at least this is conceptually what one is doing here, and join them all up to get these trajectories like this. Now, as I said, I mean, the way they actually recreated this and did the experiment, the details are slightly different, but that's the conceptual idea behind it. Okay, so this got quite a lot of publicity. You've probably heard about it. The other thing though which I like about this work, not related particularly to that experiment, is that in writing this out more generally, this is the expression one gets for the weak valued velocity, well, for the velocity field defined in terms of those weak values, if you like. So again, what I've done here is colored all those things that you don't need to know. You don't need to know the Hamiltonian of the system. You don't need to know what state you prepared the system in. You can still measure these things, and that's essentially what they did in the experiment. But I can also ask, you know, is this expression always consistent with quantum mechanics? Like we know for the Hamiltonians that they arise in standard Bohm mechanics, it does, but that is it always going to be the case? And the answer is yes, it is, if and only if your Hamiltonian is at most quadratic in operators which are canonically conjugate to X. Okay, so what's the significance of that? Well, if X is the configuration, we know that this is the case because the canonically conjugate operators are momenta, and for all the fundamental Hamiltonians we know, they are at most quadratic in the conjugate momenta. Okay, so that's good. But you might say, well, what about the cases where X is something else? Like, isn't this a limitation? You know, if I chose X to be momentum, for example, then it's not the case that the fundamental Hamiltonians are at most quadratic in position. But I'm arguing that actually you should not see this as a problem with the theory, but rather it's an explanation as to why we take X to be the configuration operator, why we actually start with this hidden variable which corresponds to the configuration, rather than starting with some other hidden variable. So not only does this approach pick out a unique velocity, it also tells you what you must choose to be your hidden variable. Okay, so does this prove that Bohm mechanics is correct, that it is actually what's going on in the world? No, of course it doesn't do that. It remains just an interpretation. All I would say is that it shows that it's a self-substantiating interpretation in the sense that it of course gives standard operational quantum mechanics as an epiphenomenon, if you like. And within that standard approach to quantum mechanics, one can get back the fundamental equations and the fundamental hidden variables from this very natural approach of using weak values. Okay, so I think it makes it a very natural theory, but that's all that one can say. Okay, what time am I supposed to finish?
Three,
okay.
Three,
okay, well, I'll try to do this bit quickly. So the other thing which lately people have been using weak values for is in this question of measurement disturbance relations. So this is something which goes back to Heisenberg, obviously back in 1927, where he wrote down an equation much like this, where this epsilon was supposed to be the error in the measurement of a position, and this e to the corresponding amount of disturbance in a momentum as a consequence. Now, Heisenberg never rigorously defined these quantities and actually never proved this equation, which people have pointed out over the years. In 2003, Japanese physicist Ozawa actually proposed some reasonable-looking definitions for these quantities. So the error in the position, so that should be A, right, for some arbitrary observable A. The error in the measurement of A he defined to be the mean squared difference between your estimate of A and the A itself. So the point, these are operator equations. So this is an operator for the estimate, okay, which is going to be a meter observable, and so it commutes with all the system observables. So that's all right. And define the disturbance in the momentum, or B more generally, as being, you know, the mean squared difference between the initial and the final B. Okay, so they look like perfectly reasonable definitions, but what he showed that is with these definitions, this measurement disturbance relation does not hold. Okay, so Heisenberg's original idea did not work, but Ozawa then pointed out that there is this more complicated thing, which he calls a measurement disturbance relation, which does always hold, which is nice to know. Okay, but one can ask, all right, so these are rather odd-looking quantities when you actually think about it, because they both of them involve quantities at two different times. So one of them is to do with the correlation, if you like, between the initial system observable here and this final estimate over here, and the other one is a correlation between the initial system B and the final system B. Okay, so of course they're well-defined operators. They exist in Hilbert space. One could measure them, okay? But that sort of defeats the purpose, because the whole idea is to ask about what happens when you do this probing, right? When you have this meter coupled to the system by some unitary U. If I assume that I know what that unitary is, then, well, there's no point doing any experiment. I can simply calculate everything I want. So what would this actually mean in an experiment where this is an unknown measurement which you're doing between the system and the probe? And so what I and Austin Lund pointed out in this paper here is that you can measure those quantities, Ozawa's quantities, again using this notion of weak value probabilities. Okay, and so I won't go through the details, but just to say that what we're doing is precisely these sort of weak probabilities of these whether you've got you're measuring a projector and your final post selection is also using a projector in order to get these weak probabilities, and you can work out those quantities as just the second moments of those distributions. So this allowed Ephraim Steinberg again to do an experiment, which was published last year, and I won't go through the details. So it was done with spins, this is the point that they were able to measure these quantities, show that Heisenberg's original relation is violated, because this is the relation here, and this is what the right-hand side should be, so it's below that, whereas if you look at Ozawa's relation, it's above that, and so everything's okay. So I won't have time to go through these examples, but this is just to show that there are many, many ways in which weak values have been applied to fundamental questions in quantum mechanics, there doesn't seem to be any slowing down in this list here, so I think that there's a lot still to be done. Okay, so conclude then. So what I'll say is that the weak values per se are not mysterious. That you can describe them simply and naturally within standard quantum theory, with non-projective measurements and post-selection. The people originally were very interested in them because they could be anomalous, okay? But that doesn't mean they're completely arbitrary. They do follow some logical properties. And in particular, what I've shown is that you can use them to measure what I call weak probabilities, and that those weak probabilities themselves have some very logical principles, even though they're not necessarily constrained between 0 and 1. And in particular, what you can use them is to actually probe unknown interactions on unknown initial states and to probe two-time statistics through that. So I've talked about how there are various fundamental questions in quantum mechanics that weak values have been applied for, and I guess this last point is probably here mainly because the original conference where I talked about this was dominated by the Bohmian trajectories, people people in that school. But nevertheless, I guess I don't mind singling that out, actually, as being, for me, what's the most important of my contributions in this area, at least. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Would you mind returning to the slide in which you introduced the PP measurements?
Okay, so way back.
The minimally disturbing property, that mathematical formulation, would you mind helping me understand why this mathematical formulation could be interpreted in terms of minimally disturbing?
Yeah. So there are, so one way to look at it is that if you, so I can always decompose an arbitrary operator into an Hermitian part and a unitary part following. So I can. So this is one way to think of this. Is this is just saying that the unitary part is the identity. Okay. So that the measurement, whatever acts on the system, is solely determined by these operators here, which are telling you about the information you get. Okay. So given if I say these tell me the information I get from my system, there's, you know, infinite number of measurements which are compatible with that because I could always have unitaries acting after, and so this is saying the unitary is the identity. If you want a mathematical statement about why that's minimally disturbing, one could, for example, consider doing an average over all the pure states and ask, given that I'm making a measurement with this pure VM, which one of the possible ways of making those measurements will lead to the maximum average fidelity between my final state and my initial state, the answer will be these minimally disturbed.
If the corresponding unitary is the identity, would it be incorrect to interpret that as saying the measurement basically does not evolve the state much, or is it a different?
Well, I don't know what you mean by much. You have exactly as much back action as you need, given that you got out information corresponding to this POEM, and no further back action. Does that make sense?
It's a good start for building my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you.
Yes.
So you mentioned that anomalous weak values cannot arise classically.
Yeah.
On the grounds that if the either the final effect or the initial state commuted A, then you would have a constraint spectrum. But what about a different notion of classicality? What if I wanted to know, is it possible for me to have a local non-contextual hidden variable model of anomalous weak values or a systemic hidden variable model?
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, I wouldn't need either the final effect or the initial state.
Well, okay, so non-locality clearly isn't relevant because we're only talking about one system.
That's
true. But if you are asking the question about, right, could you get this effect in a non-contextual theory?
Yeah. So all I'm saying is that there are kind of classical-like sub-theories of quantum mechanics that incorporate non-orthogonal states and non-orthogonal measurements. So you wouldn't necessarily satisfy that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's a sense in which those are all classical because, for example, the Wigner representation is positive for all these states and effects.
Yeah, so I don't know. Well, do you know the answer to that question?
No.
Okay. No, that's an interesting question. So I don't know whether it's relevant to that question, but this might point, if you know something about it, that Williams and Jordan in 2008 showed an equivalence between the Leggett-Gargan quality and the anomalous weak values at the intermediate step in that sequence of three measurements. So if you can say something about Leggett-Gargan quality and contextuality, then maybe that will tell you something about weak value contextuality.
So my sense is that violating a Leggett-Gargan equality does not imply a failure of non-contextuality.
Okay.
So that evidence suggests that you will have anomalous weak values.
Okay.
In these sorts of models.
Okay, so that's interesting. So yes, so when I, obviously when I said classical, I meant as a, yeah, the when quantum mechanics essentially reduces to a classical diagonal, where everything is diagonal. Although, yeah, it doesn't even have to be. Yeah, in fact, it's when either, yeah, when you can either co-diagonalize the initial statement A or the final.
Which means that all the off diagonals of the third one are irrelevant anyhow.
Because it's just, that's right. Yeah.
But so that's interesting. So if that conjecture turns out to be true, that you can't have those anomalous values, then by virtue of your connection with Bell correlations, there'd sort of be a question of, you know, what is the criteria on weak values such that something truly non-classical is happening in the sense that it does not admit of a non-contextual invariable model. And it won't just be that the values are anomalous, it'll have to be something.
No.
More than that.
Interesting question. Yeah.
So you said you'd like to define the weak values as just being the real part of these quantities. When you gave the tunneling example, you said that the imaginary part had some physical significance there. So is there some general notion of
The imaginary part turned out to I don't know if I said it had physical significance, but it turned out to be related to this time which had previously been proposed. And I guess there was some physical significance to that time in the sense that, yeah, this was related to a physical thing. So, yeah, maybe that's fair enough to say. But your question is, in general, what does the imaginary part have to do with it? So in the original AAB setup, the imaginary part was to do with a shift in the phase of the meter rather than in its, so what I mean by phase. So it's something like a shift in, I probably don't want to say this, I'll probably say it wrong. But I think in general, it probably does have something to do with the properties of the meter, but it doesn't have anything to do with the thing that you're actually measuring. Yes.
So you have this sort of support for a Bohm ontology of some. Then at the same time, you have negative probabilities using those.
In a completely different experiment.
In a different experiment.
Yes.
And then you have, I don't know if this dwell time stuff is consistent with the de Broglie-Bohm particle, but it's equal to the amount of time that de Broglie-Bohm particle would spend in.
I wouldn't say necessarily no.
So then my question is there any hope of a sort of unified ontology emerging out of this approach that you could actually say this is the correct picture, this is the best picture according to some spectral?
Yeah, no, no, I mean, what you point out is very valid, the example I've given are very different applications of the theory very different fields, and that there's no particular relation between them. So I don't want to claim that weak values per se force you in any particular direction. It really depends on what you want to apply them to. So I think Aharonov has some idea that weak values give you an ontology. I find his writings on that very unclear, actually. It's not clear to me at all in what way they give you they could be considered to give you an ontology. So this is partly why I changed the, rather than saying foundation for quantum mechanics, because I'm not claiming that weak values gives you a new foundation for quantum mechanics, whereas I think Aharonov might say that they do. I would just say that they give you new ways of looking at all sorts of fundamental questions. And as I said, I mean, all I can say is that for me, the most interesting thing that they say is applied to this Bohmian question, but that's probably just my bias about what sort of ontologies are attractive.
What have you thought about going beyond quantum theory, the new theory? Is there any sort of insight that one might gain from this sort of
Yeah, I can't say I have anything
particularly to say about that, but I mean, I guess it would, I guess one thing one could say is that the formulating this in term in the sort of operational sense at least gives you a notion of weak values that perhaps could be formulated in if some sort of super generalizations in any theory.
So you obviously reckon you could formulate those in a generalized
way? Well, at least it's plausible that you could.
No one's done that yet.
Not that I'm aware of, no.
But it should be, given your formulation, it should be quite easy to.
I would guess so, yeah. And so maybe then that would be a, I mean, yeah, possibly if then in that theory, the ontology of the weak values in that theory matched up, sorry, the ontology of that theory matched up more closely to the weak values that you were getting in that theory, then maybe that would be telling you something. That's a huge speculation.
Right.
So somewhat related to that and this Bellman local things.
Mm-hmm.
So you seem to use the weak values to sort of choose one particular negative probability hidden variable for it. And so you can get negative probability hidden variables for any no signaling correlations, right? So
yes.
it's not restricted quantum mechanics.
Well, with weak probabilities.
Well, I mean, negative probabilities.
Well, we constrain these to be no signaling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure. Well, so what I'm saying is, if you just have probabilities, the only constraint is no signaling, and you don't have quantum mechanics.
Sorry, the only constraint is.
It's no signaling. You don't necessarily have quantum mechanics.
Right.
So that there is still a negative probability hidden variable.
I would imagine.
I mean, there actually several of them.
Mm-hmm.
But you seem to use in a quantum mechanical case, you seem to use the weak values to choose one particular, particular one of these. So would these be more general?
If you're postulating correlations that can't occur in quantum mechanics, then it's not clear what would even mean to physically probe those as weak values. I mean, if you have a PR box or something.
Sure, but I guess you could still define what a weak value would be.
Well, possibly. I guess you said it was related to Lucien's question. I can see, yes. So maybe if you had a theory which gave you stronger than quantum correlations and was a sufficiently detailed theory that you were able to talk about weak values in those theories, presumably you would get unique. You would get unique negative probabilities in that theory as well, but what they say, I don't.
What are the actual unique negative probabilities that you think about?
Sorry.
So in a say a Bell scenario or a Hardy paradox scenario, what are the actual negative probabilities you think about?
Well, I mean, so these are the measurements of them. So I did this very quickly. I mean, I guess it turns out that in this case, all of the probabilities either have, there are only two, so all the probabilities group into two families, unless there are some that are zero. I don't think so. I think they actually all fall into two families. So either all of them are this value, which is up near one, or this value down near zero. So those are the. So I can't actually remember in the experiment whether this is an average over all of them or if this was just measuring one of them. But these are the probabilities that come out of the theory. So I guess there are eight, I think, from memory. Is that right? There are eight of them in general, and they fall into two groups of four or something like that. I can't remember.
Any more questions? Thank you.
All right.